So this week's study is on the doctrine of man and sin. So we've been going through what you might call anthropology, a biblical anthropology, understanding man made in the image of God, understanding man as male and female and those complementary roles in God's design. We looked at last week trichotomy versus dichotomy, whether man is essentially are we to think of man as tripartite, body, soul, and spirit, or is it easier to understand the biblical teaching as man, as dichotomy, material and immaterial? I argued for a dichotomy position. This week, we're going to study the doctrine of man and sin. And so while man is made in the image of God, man was made upright. That is not the state of man today. And so point number one is man's inherited guilt. Turn to Romans chapter 12. We're going to be reading, Romans chapter 5, verse 12. We're going to be reading verse 12 to 21. And let's divvy it up. Eric, we'll start with you reading, and then you could pass it on to Matt and Devin. Why don't you read like three verses apiece? I'm just going to read around the room.
Therefore, just as though one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sin. So instead of us, sin was in the world, but sin is not excused where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned, in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come.
But the free gift is not like the transgression, for by the transgression of the one, the many died. Much more did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abound to the many. The gift is not like that which came through the man who sinned. So on the one hand, the judgment arose from one transgression, resulting in condemnation. But on the other hand, the free gift arose from many transgressions, resulting in justification.
For if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one, much more those who receive the abundance of grace and of the gift of righteousness will reign in life through the one, Jesus Christ. So then, as through one transgression resulted, there resulted condemnation to all men, even so through one act of righteousness there resulted justification of life to all men. For as through the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners,
so let's think about this passage a little bit more thoroughly. So in verse 12, it speaks of this one man. Who is the one man?
Adam.
Okay. One man is Adam. And what is the result of his sin? Yeah, death spreads to all men. Now, who else sinned when Adam sinned, according to verse 12? All sinned. So this is kind of the one of the questions. So Adam sinned, and we all sinned in Adam. And so this is the teaching what's sometimes called inherited guilt, where we're all guilty in Adam. Now, there's been two dominant views in church history. Well, actually, probably three, but two that are more within the realm of orthodoxy as to how sin or guilt was transmitted from us or to us from Adam. The one is that sin is transmitted seminally through the seed of man. The other position is that sin is transmitted representatively, or sometimes called federally. And then the third option is that it's transferred by example. That third option, by example, what theological school do you think that's from? He was Augustine's nemesis. Begins with a P.
Pelagian.
There you go, Pelagian. That's kind of the Pelagian school's position that, so in that sense, guilt is not necessarily transmitted. It's only transmitted when all follow in the footsteps of Adam. Okay? And so, so basically the two kind of schools of thought that are within the realm of gospel-believing Christians are whether sin is transmitted seminally, biologically, or whether sin is transmitted because Adam is our representative, our federal head. And as I want you to think about that, to think as the text of Romans 5 unfolds, which fits a little, which position fits a little bit better with Romans 5. So when we look at verse 13, any questions on those positions up to this point? Verse 13 and 14, what is the thrust of Paul's argument here? He says, I'll read again. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Okay, when did God give the law? What's that?
Moses.
Okay, with Moses. So with Moses at Sinai. Okay, but was Moses the first human being? No, he comes kind of later down the road, right? Even after Joseph and the 12 sons of Jacob, Moses was of the tribe of Levi. So. What's the thrust of Paul's argument in verse 14?
Is it that they didn't even know what sin was, if they didn't know what the law was, to know what they were going against?
Yeah, so the law was not given until Moses, but from Adam to Moses, what took place?
Sin did.
Sin did, and how do you know? Okay, so what's the evidence that there was sin from Adam to Moses? Death. Funerals. Right? That's the consequence, you know. Death came after sin entered the world, and the evidence that people had sinned in Adam is that they died. They died even though the law had not been given. Now, this is one little caveat without going down an entire rabbit trail, but this is one of the reasons why I get nervous when people start arguing for the salvation of children who die in infancy by arguing that God doesn't hold them accountable for the sin of Adam. Because the very fact that they die is evidence of what? They have inherited the sin of Adam, or else they wouldn't die, because death is the consequence of sin. Now, I'm not arguing against the salvation of infants who die. I am arguing against that theological rationale for it. There's some texts that we tend to lean heavy into, but I think that's a dangerous theological line of thinking, if that makes sense. Yeah, Matt.
Back to verse 13. For until the law. What wasn't the law given? I mean, I know what it's saying, the law that Moses received.
Mm-hmm.
But wasn't the law given almost from the Garden of Eden? And God told him what not to do? Is that the law?
In a certain sense, God's standard as God was laid out. I would also say, according to Romans 2, the work of the law was written on man's heart, so that there was a sense of right and wrong before the law was given. That being true, it seems that Paul's argument here in Romans 5 is that the law, it wasn't explicitly spelled out in the revelation of God, yet death still happened. And so that's kind of the line, it seems to me that's the line of his argument for a kind of inherited sin from Adam. Now notice in verse 15 to 17, there's three contrasts in these verses. What are the contrasts in verse 15?
Free gift is not like the offense.
Okay, so there's a contrast between a gift that abounds to the many, and what's that contrasted with?
Sin.
Yeah, the transgression that leads to what?
Death.
Okay. And then in verse 16, there's a contrast. What's the contrast in verse 16? Good. Condemnation or judgment and justification. And then in verse 17, what's the contrast? Death and the reign of life. So he's drawing contrast between the gift and death, judgment, justification, death, and life. And then in verse 18 and 19, what are the similarities that he makes? What are the similarities that, he draws our attention to? Okay, so righteousness, which one act of righteousness that brings justification of life to all, and that's similar to what? Yeah, one transgression. So one act of righteousness. What do you think that one act of righteousness is? That brings justification of life to all men. Yeah. Obedience, whose obedience? Christ's obedience, and specifically, as was mentioned, Christ's death. And so then what's the one transgression? Yeah, Adam's disobedience. Okay, so that's the similarity. And then in verse 19, what's the similarity there? Yep, so one man, one act. In verse 18, one act results in condemnation to all men. One act results in justification to all men. Verse 19, then one man's disobedience results in many being made sinners. One man's obedience results in many being made righteous. Okay? So when we think about, so you can see the contrast and the similarities. There's a result of death, there's a result of life. There's a result of judgment, there's a result of justification. The similarities, it's through one man, it's through one act, but on the one hand resulting in death, condemnation, on the other hand resulting in justification. So when we think, okay, go back to are three possibilities of transmission of guilt from Adam, whether it happens seminally, like biologically, whether it happens through example, or whether it happens through representation. Which position best fits what Paul is arguing for here, and why? What's that, Matt? Okay, why do you say that? Okay, yeah, so how...
I've never seen Adam do anything, so I couldn't follow the example. I mean, simple way of putting it.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah. And how do we receive the righteousness of Christ? It's through faith, and he becomes our representative, right? So... it would seem to be consistent. Christ, we know he's our representative. That's how we're righteous in him. So, and because the comparison, that's part of the similarity through one act of obedience, through one act of disobedience, through one man this, through one man that, that the way in which sin is transmitted from Adam would be the same way in which righteousness is transmitted to believers, namely through representation. Because we're not seminally related to Christ in that sense. We know we're not, because Christ didn't have any children. He didn't have any offspring. And so it seemed best to understand the way in which this guilt is inherited from Adam is through representation. Namely, he was our representative head in the Garden of Eden. He acted on behalf of humanity. Okay. Questions, comments, gripes, complaints? Matt? What's that? Oh, that's your complaint. Okay. What are some objections? What would be an objection to this teaching? Kind of grates against our American individualism, huh? And don't get me wrong, there is a biblical kind of individualism. You know, I mean, we saw it this morning, you know. the one who does not believe is judged already. You know, you don't get saved corporately in that sense. You know, you don't get justified corporately. There is a biblical kind of individualism. But I think our kind of gut response to something like this is what? It's not...
fairness.
Right, it's not fair, right? I wasn't in the garden. I didn't do that. Why am I being punished for what Adam did? How would you respond to that?
Well, you have to share the gospel for them to even understand it at all. But I mean, I guess you could start with creation, but if they don't, they don't believe in that, and they're saying that doesn't make sense, then you have, I don't know, I think you should start with the gospel and then go back.
Yeah, it's definitely not something that... Sure. But even for ourselves, I mean, you know, it's a legitimate question, right? I mean, how am I, you know, punished for Adam's sin? Do we have any examples today of individuals making decisions on behalf of groups? Yeah, I mean, anytime you have government, they're making decisions on behalf of others, whether we like it or not, it don't matter, it is what it is. What's that?
Everything's a group now. Everybody's in a different group. We've got the feminist movement group, we've got the LGBTQ group, we've got there's so many groups.
Yeah, you got the Oxy, you got the Black Matters group just as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's all kinds of identity politics, but even, you know, those groups that, like family, so if a father makes a decision to take a job in South Dakota and the whole family, you know, has to move, that individual's decision has affected everybody else in the family. Again, if, you know, whatever... If a leader decides to go to war against another country, even though in our country it's supposed to be Congress that makes that decision, that's kind of unfortunately gone by the wayside. Then it affects everybody, right? It affects everybody in this country. And so we have that example of one making a decision as a representative, and others being affected by that decision, even in our very individualistic society today. Also, the good news of the gospel is one of representation, right? In other words, if you don't like that Adam was your representative, well then choose to have Jesus as your representative. That's a better deal. Because you didn't live the perfect life that he lived, but you can get his representation to stand before God, even though you don't deserve it. Any other comments, questions?
That's a good way to say it. You don't like Adam's representation.
Yeah, I mean, God has given us a wonderful representative in Christ. Okay. I guess I give some other examples here. Okay, any questions on man's inherited guilt? Okay, let's move on to man's inherited corruption. Turn to Psalm 51:5. And Mom, I'll have you read that. And while you're turning there, this is actually kind of one of those fun doctrines that's not popular, but is so easy to prove. I somewhat did that this morning when I mentioned, if you don't believe man is wicked, you just need to have children, right? Because it's so easy. I remember one time we were sharing the gospel with some Muslims, and Islam teaches that man is born basically neutral. And the one guy we were talking to, we had gone over each other's house. He had us over his house one time, and he had three boys, and it seemed like some pretty rambunctious boys. And so it was an easy, so do you have to teach your boys to do wrong? Do you have to teach them to fight with each other? Do you have to teach them to lie? He's like, no, I don't teach. Well, why do you think they just naturally do that? According to the Quran, they're born neutral. Everybody's born a Muslim. Everybody's born neutral. They should naturally obey you, but they don't, do they? He didn't really respond to that, but and yet it's a very unpopular doctrine, right? It grates against our kind of contemporary Western thinking, because we think we're all good and we're born good, and God's nice, we're nice, be nice kind of theology. Psalm 51:5. Okay, and so what's the context of this psalm?
10.
Yeah, sin. David's sin, right, after having committed sin with Bathsheba and doing away with her husband. This is his prayer of repentance. And what does he say about his conception? Yeah, he was brought forth in iniquity, in sin my mother conceived me. Now, some have tried to escape this by saying he's talking about how his mom conceived him in a sinful way, in an illicit way. That's just silly. That doesn't even fit. If you're confessing your sin, you don't talk about your mom's sin. You're talking about your own sin. He's saying, this is who I am. I'm conceived in iniquity. This is my very nature, is to sin. It's part of his prayer of confession. It was J.C. Ryle who used to, when he would want to prove the doctrine of man's sinfulness, he would, from the pulpit, he would shake his keys. Why do you have all these keys? Why do you lock things? because you don't want your stuff getting stolen, right? We get all these keys because man is sinful. Again, it's one of those doctrines that's very easy to prove in our human experience, and yet is very unpopular. Psalm 58:3. Eric, why don't you read that one for us?
The wicked are estranged from womb. These who speak lies go astray from birth.
Okay, so when does it start? When does this sinfulness begin to manifest itself, according to verse 3? Yeah, from the womb, from birth, from the earliest days. Ephesians 2:3. Matt, I'll have you read that.
Indulging in desires of the flesh and of the mind, or by no, and by nature, children of wrath, and
not trust. Okay. So Paul here is describing the Ephesian believers in their B.C. days, and how does he describe them? Notice the verbs that he uses. How does he describe these Ephesians believers before Christ?
Lust of the flesh, desire of the flesh and mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By nature, children of wrath. And then notice this last phrase, even as the rest. So it wasn't that these Ephesians were particularly evil in a unique way before God raised them to life, but just like the rest of fallen humanity. And so there's a slight distinction here. We inherit guilt from Adam, so that we're guilty in Adam, but we also inherit corruption as well, that our nature, so we're not only born guilty, we're born bad, if that makes sense. We're born corrupt with a bent against the Lord. Any questions or comments on this? Yeah, John?
Would these verses be good for connecting it to that we deserve hell?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, because it's... Yeah, because when you understand man's nature, that's why we deserve hell, is because our corruption.
I mean, I like your idea, what we were talking about before, how, obviously, even though we have a genealogy of sinful behavior because of Adam, but yet, why not choose Christ, because that's more better? God also had a plan, because he knew that we were going to be simple creatures, and that's why his plan is loving, by sending his son to the cross, by taking on the whole wrath himself. That way our case would be dismissed. But honestly, this is like a really good verse that you can use to back up your words just as well. So I agree with John on
it. Yeah. Yep. Good. Yeah, I mean, obviously it wouldn't be the only place. You'd have to go to those texts that explicitly spell out hell. But that's usually the biggest gripe against hell is again, it doesn't seem fair. But once we understand God himself is the standard of right and wrong, we're not the standard. What I feel doesn't matter, doesn't make something true, whether I feel good about it or whether I feel bad about it. And God himself is this, if he says it's right, then it's right, even if I can't fully understand how that's fair or just. I don't have a standard of justice outside of God himself. He is the standard. And so once somebody starts trying to think or believe independently of God's standard and then sit in judgment over God as if they were the standard of right and wrong, now we got a problem. That's foolishness. That's arrogant thinking.
I forget what scripture I used when a person objected to that. The woman said, you don't deserve anything. In fact, you deserve hell. Or does the Bible say that? So I gave two or three scriptures that came to my head. Well, it doesn't directly say that.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, well, show me the scriptures that say we deserve heaven.
Yeah.
You couldn't come up with scriptures that say we deserve heaven either. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric?
Well, obviously, there's a factor out there, too. And I learned that this past week. It was a conversation that I had with someone in Brandywine Apartments where she she overheard me talk to a Catholic, and she wanted to put her opinion in it. But it wasn't because she was curious about being saved. She was just wanting to win a debate.
Mm-hmm.
Come down to. So it's like when you are trying to take and try to explain something, and somebody is just very rebellious against it, it doesn't even want to hear it. It's really just time to move on, because really at that point I feel like God did not regenerate your heart for that kind of thinking, to want to sit there and learn more about the good news to be saved. She just wanted to express her own opinion, which makes me think of Proverbs. I don't remember what verse by hand, but I remember where it says they have no understanding. A fool has no understanding,
but only in expressing
his
own opinion.
Yeah,
I think it's Proverbs 18:2.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, at that time, I think the conversation is over, just to move on.
Yeah, there's discernment that's needed. At what point am I tossing pearls before swine? And Lord knows, I think I've sometimes let the conversation go on too long.
Because
I like a good intellectual judo match. Man's point number three is man's inherited total corruption. And what I mean by this is what's commonly called total depravity. If somebody asks you, what is total depravity, how would you answer that? Okay, not having the ability to choose.
Tainted with sin.
Okay. What about the word total?
That describes your tenth sinful nature itself.
Would it be like that?
Okay, completely. Does that mean that man is as evil as he could be? No, right? We might call that ultimate depravity. I don't know if anybody on planet Earth is ultimately depraved in that sense, but total depravity is completely in the sense of all of man's faculties are tainted by corruption. So that man's mind is affected by sin, his will, his emotions, everything is corrupted by sin. And therefore, as John alluded to, he's unable to turn towards the Lord because he can't change his nature apart from something outside of himself. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5. John, let me read that one. There's always a temptation to point at the screen to change, but ain't nothing up there to change.
Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
Okay, so I'll never forget in beginning Hebrew class, the professor had us translate Genesis chapter 1 and 2, and then our next assignment was to translate Genesis 6. And I think it was intentional by the professor, because it was just like there was such a dark contrast between Genesis 1 and 2. You know, it's happy, it's amazing, God's handiwork, man is part of that exceedingly good part of creation that God designed. Then you get to chapter 6, and it's bad. And it was a very helpful theological lesson when he had us do that. But notice that the words that are used here to describe the totality of man's wickedness. How many intentions of man are wicked?
Every.
How many thoughts? every intent of the thoughts of his heart. How often are they evil? Continually. How is the wickedness of man described? Great. It's kind of shocking language here, right? Every intent of the thoughts of his heart, only evil continually. It's a pretty bleak picture of humanity. And it's interesting, when you trace like the history of religions and philosophies, you will never find any belief system, any religion, any philosophy that teaches this. You know, sometimes there's like an intersection of certain ideas, beliefs. You'll never find any religion, any philosophy, any belief system that teaches man's state is this bad. And I think that's because all other belief systems are man-made. We have a pretty good assessment of ourselves. We think we're sweet. We think we're not that bad. And yet, obviously, when we, you know, we had lessons on man in the image of God, there is human dignity. The scripture accounts for that, the reality that in one sense we are amazing creatures made in the image of God, the capacity to think, to reason, to invent, to build, all kinds of stuff. But we're corrupt. Only biblical Christianity can make sense of those two realities. And that it actually teaches that man is, on the one hand, majestic creature made in the image of God, on the other hand, is horribly wicked and horribly evil. Romans chapter 3, verse 9 through 18. Why don't we take three verses at a time? Eric, you can start, and Devin, please try not to usurp any verses this time. Read three verses.
All right, Romans 3, chapter 9, verses 9 through 18. I'm going to go down to 12. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under sin. As it is written, none righteous, not even one.
Okay, stop there. So, how many are considered to be righteous?
None.
Not even one. Okay, verse 11.
There is none who understands, it says there's none who understands, and there is none who seeks for God.
Okay, so where is man's understanding? What faculty do we normally call that? Man. Yeah, the mind, or maybe the heart. I mean, even last week's lesson, we think out of the soul and the spirit as well. But sometimes this is called the noetic effects of sin, not like Noah and the ark, but Noah, N-O-E-T-I-C, noetic effects of sin. And it's from the Greek word nous, which is mind. And so this is the effects of the sin on the mind, that our thinking has been corrupted by sin. We don't understand rightly the things of the Lord because it's skewed by sin. It's a lot of what I was saying this morning, that man loves the darkness. He loves lies. Now, man would never say that, oh, I want to be lied to, I want to believe lies. No, but inherently, he loves lies, and especially those lies that enable him to continue in sin, to rationalize his sin. I'll never forget, I think it was Greg Bonson who said, talking about evolution, he said, the world was waiting to believe that lie. Why? It gives them an out. If there's some other explanation for how this world came into existence that I don't have to be accountable to the Creator, I'm going to believe it. The human heart is going to gravitate towards lies. So that's the noetic effects of sin. It affects the thinking. And again, it's not to say that, you know, every unbeliever is stupid. You know, there's a lot of Christians that are stupid. It's not to say that people are dumb necessarily, but their thinking has been skewed because of a love of sin. It affects the thinking. We can be thankful that in God's common grace that, you know, there's smart unbelievers who know how to design airplanes and, you know, car engines and stuff like that. Then he says there's none who seeks God. How many seek for God?
None.
Okay, so there's a whole church growth movement, a seeker-friendly movement, catering to people who don't exist, right? At least according to this verse. Now, where, what aspect of man does the seeking? What's that? If you get up this evening, go to the cupboard, you're looking for something sweet, you're seeking it. Why are you doing that? Your desires, your will, your wants. Okay? This is your will is tainted by sin so that you don't seek for God, not the true and living God. And again, people do seek for God, but because they're born again, because God does that work in their heart. But Paul is describing humanity, fallen humanity, apart from the grace of God. Did you have a question or comment?
No, I think, yeah, you pretty
much just clarify.
Yeah,
okay, pick it up, verse 12. Who's next, Matt? Read 12 to 14.
All are turned aside. Together they become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one.
Okay, you stop. So how many have turned aside? Oh, everybody. What do you think he means by turned aside? Turned aside from what? Turn aside from the truth, turn aside from the Lord's ways. I think of Isaiah 53, was it verse 6? We all, like sheep, have what? Gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. Describing man turning away from the Lord. And then in verse 12, you might think, well, maybe if we just put all of humanity together and the sum total, at least there's some goodness in man. But what does the second phrase in verse 12 say?
There's not even one.
Together, you add them all together, what's it amount to?
Yeah.
Useless. Not very flattering, huh? And then how many do good? None. And the doing, what might we call that in regards to man? Man's what?
Work.
Man's work, man's actions. So man's mind, man's will, man's actions, man's nature. The sum total of man, it's all tainted by sin. Continue on verse 13.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably another good, obviously this is a good verse to use whenever we go out to show people that there is a kind of good in there.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Verse 13.
Their throat is milk and gray, with their tongue they keep the secret. The poison of asp is on their lips.
Okay, notice this, this, how is the throat described?
An open grave.
Okay, an open grave. What's happening with an open grave?
Rotting,
decomposition. I mean, talk about an awful smell, right? You know, sometimes, you know, just the, even the smell of a little rodent, or, you know, you're walking down the street and there's a dead raccoon lying there. I mean, you get within 10 feet and that is just awful smell. You know, how much more? I've never smelled a decomposing human being, but, you know, that's a lot more meat decomposing there. I mean, that would be an awful, awful smell. That's some bad breath. Their throat, it smells like that. How about their tongues? Keep deceiving. How about their lips? Poisonous. How about their mouth? So, not a pretty picture. And then, verse 15 and 16. Is that Devin's turn?
Their feet are swift to shed blood, destruction and misery are in their path.
Might as well read 17 and 18, short.
In the path of peace they have not known, there is no fear of God in their eyes.
Okay, feet swift to shed blood. You think of 170 million people murdered last century by the hands of their own government. All the number of abortions since 1973 in this country. Our hands are bloody. Destruction and misery. Path of peace. Not a pretty picture, right? Shows us our desperate need. And this is all in the book of Romans as part of Paul's argument to set up the good news of the gospel. He's painting this realistic but very bleak picture of humanity apart from the grace of God. Any questions, comments on that?
It is.
Okay, man's inherited inability. And so this inability flows out of man's nature that is corrupt. John 6:44. John, why don't you read that? You can read that and 6:65. Yeah, I quoted it this morning.
No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, he makes them all be taught by God. Therefore, everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to
him. Okay, so how many people can come to Jesus? What does it say in verse 44? How many can come to Jesus? No one, right? And remember the difference between can and may? Can speaks of what? Ability. May speaks of permission. No one can come to me. No one has the ability to come to me unless what? The Father draws. And what's the result? What's the final result? They'll be raised up so that, because sometimes, you know, the Arminian position is that, well, Jesus' death basically gives all of humanity the ability to come to Jesus. The semi-Pelagian position is that man, there's still some vestige of righteousness still in man that he can come. The Arminian position why wouldn't the Arminian position fit with this passage? I mean, it's obvious why the semi-Pelagian wouldn't, because, well, he says no one can come. But why wouldn't the Arminian position that Jesus died so that everybody has the ability? So they would say, yeah, nobody can come unless the Father draws. He draws everybody. So he draws everybody, but then you just have to choose. What's that?
It says here, no one can come to me unless the Father draws. So the Arminians believe that we choose. The Father draws us, but we have choice. I mean, we have an act that we've achieved. So it's partly our doing and going to heaven because we said yes. Well, we said, I believe.
Okay. So they would say, yeah, nobody can come unless the Father who sent me draws him, but the Father draws everybody. He's an equal opportunity God. He draws everybody. But what's the problem with that based off of this verse? There you go. If he draws everybody, then everybody is raised up on the last day. Everybody reaches glorification. So it can't be talking. It can't be that the Father draws everybody based off of this verse. John 6:65. No one can come unto me unless it has been granted him by the Father. So similar verse. It doesn't mention the drawing of the Father, but it has to be given from the Father. John 15:5. Mom, can you read that one?
I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing.
Okay, so what can people do apart from Jesus?
Nothing.
And in this context, the nothing must be referring to fruit bearing, right? So that there's not going to be any fruit. You lack the ability to produce fruit apart from Jesus. 1 Corinthians 2:14. Eric, can you read that one? It's before 2 Corinthians.
Before 3
Corinthians. Mom, showing you that to the words. Oh, cool. Because I was going to use this verse earlier, too. Yeah. But a natural man does not accept the things in the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. He needs understanding because they are spiritually afraid. I go back to that conversation I said that I had with that woman. You know, she doesn't really understand because God hasn't shown it to her yet.
Yeah, and so it mentions the natural man here. Who's the natural man? Sounds like a hair product or something. The natural man.
The natural man, I would say, is the one that does not understand.
Right, so it's the person who hasn't been born again. They don't have the Spirit of God. They're man as he is in his natural state. And notice again this phrase again, cannot. It's actually the same phrase you see in all these other passages, same phrase in John 3:3, John 3:5, Romans 8:7, may dunamai, you cannot. Not able. Okay. And so this one, he cannot understand them. He does not accept them. They're regarded as foolish to him. Romans 8:7-8. Matt, read that one for us. Okay, so the mind set on the flesh, what is that contrasted with in this section? Yeah, the mind set on the Spirit. And so he's contrasting those who have the Spirit of God and those who do not have the Spirit of God. And so the mind set on the flesh is the person who's not been born again. And what is their relationship with God like in verse 7? Yeah, hostile. We saw that this morning, right? Light came into the darkness. Men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds are evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light. They're hostile towards God. Yeah, rebellious. What is their relationship to God's standard, His law? Yeah, does not subject itself. Refuse to obey. They will not have Christ to rule over them. And then he says, they're what? They're not even able to do so. And they cannot please God. So all these cannots, right? Lots of cannots in the New Testament. Now, again, what's the kind of normal knee-jerk reaction when you see these cannot verses?
Arrogance. I mean, man has pride. They think that they can do these things.
Okay, so it grates against our pride because we think we can. But normally when somebody cannot do something, normally we don't hold them responsible for that, right? If I commanded Eric to dunk basketball in the hoop outside and he cannot, and I put him under church discipline because he cannot dunk a basketball, we'd say that's ridiculous, right? Or something more serious. What if somebody was a paraplegic and they're supposed to run, you know, a mile during physical education, you know, under 10 minutes, and they cannot. And we say, no, you have to do it. Normally, inability is not, we don't hold people responsible for inability, right? So, somebody says, well, how can we be responsible? It says, I cannot. How am I responsible? God's going to send me to hell for something I can't do. How are you going to respond?
Because he gives you that ability.
Does he give it to everybody?
No. Yes.
No one can come unto me unless the Father who sent me draws him. The Arminian position would be that he gives that ability to everybody. Prevenient grace, they call it. Do we have examples of inability that still still remains responsibility, culpability? If somebody drinks a 12-pack of beer gets behind the wheel, gets pulled over, police officer gives them a sobriety test, and they cannot walk a straight line. Are they not responsible to walk a straight line? No, they aren't, right? But they can't. So we do have some examples, but this is where Jonathan Edwards distinguished between there's moral inability and there's physical inability. And when the Bible describes this kind of inability, it's a moral inability that is rooted in man's nature and man's desires that makes it a responsible inability. Here, a helpful contrast is in Genesis 37, verse 4. By the way, this is in Edwards' Freedom of the Will. It's also, you can read it in A.W. Pink's book. I'm sure you can find it online free somewhere. It's called Gleanings on Man, I think. It's basically his book on man's sinfulness. Genesis 37, 4. Whose turn is it to read? Devin, go ahead.
His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms.
Okay, so whose brothers? Who's this talking about? His brothers? Joseph's brothers, okay. What was their relationship with Joseph? They hated him, okay. Why did they hate Joseph? He was daddy's favorite, right? He was the fruit of the relationship that Jacob really wanted. Remember, he worked 7 years for her, and you know, he wakes up on his wedding morning the day after. Evidently, he must have drunk a few too many, because the woman he was with the previous night was not Rachel, it was Leah. But Leah, evidently, while not as attractive as Rachel, was tremendously fertile. And Leah kept having babies out the gazoo, but Rachel was only able to have Joseph, and then later on Benjamin. She died having Benjamin. But Joseph was his favorite. And so notice, what does it speak of their ability to speak kindly or friendly or peaceably to Joseph? They could not. Now, this could not was not a physical inability, right? It wasn't like they had a speech impediment. It wasn't like they had their tongues cut out. They had the equipment to speak kindly to him, but they did not have the will to speak kindly to him. Why didn't they have the will? What was their disposition towards Joseph? They hated him. And so they had a moral inability to speak kindly to Joseph that was rooted in their hatred towards Joseph. And so it is with man. Our inability to come to Christ is rooted in our hatred of Christ. We will not come to Christ. We lack the ability to come to Christ because we will not come to Christ. And we lack the capacity to change our own nature. Right? Can, you know, was it Jeremiah? Can a leopard change his spots? Can an Ethiopian change the color of his skin? No, he can't. How can you, who are accustomed to doing evil, do good? We lack the ability to change our nature and therefore our own desires, and so because of that we're unable to come to Christ. That's why we need to be born again. That's why we need regeneration. Any questions, comments, John?
Trying to point finger at God instead of understanding how bad we are, you know, like going back to Noah's verse in Noah, where God was sorry that he had made man.
Mm-hmm.
They use that verse to say that God didn't know that he made everybody good in the first place, and they chose to do bad. God didn't ordain it from the beginning. They hate that word ordained.
Yeah, although I would say, I mean, historical Arminianism believes in God's foreknowledge, so they would have to say God knows the future, unless it was like an open theism position that teaches God doesn't know the future, which is...
They actually believe that God chooses. They just don't know that they believe that God chooses them.
Because the way they say it, man, they'll say God chose... So God knew
he was going to choose that to man's freedom, free will. They link that to man's free will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I think you're right. This is, it's a lack, the Arminian position is a lack of understanding man's nature. I mean, all these verses. I don't know how you can account for man having ability, whether through some innate semi-Pelagianism position or Arminian through prevenient grace that's distributed all, it just doesn't jive with these passages. And man's nature, it's like somebody described it, it's like buttoning a shirt, you know. When you start off wrong, you know, if I button the first one wrong, everything's going to go wrong thereafter. If you start with man's nature and don't rightly understand man's nature, everything's going to follow from there, and it's going to be off. And likewise, if you get man's nature right, man's corrupt. He's not coming to Christ. He lacks the ability. Then now, this is why we need God's grace and regenerate. This is why we believe that regeneration is monergistic. God has to do this in us for us to believe. This is why regeneration precedes faith, because man wouldn't do that. Oh, and then that makes sense that he would have chosen to do this, you know, before the beginning of time. That's one of the reasons I think never mind. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just went back up because I got confused when it comes to the drunk analogy. Were you saying that they don't know that they're getting drunk and driving? Or?
No, what I'm saying is there are examples of inability in society today where we still hold people responsible.
Yeah, because they know farewell that when they drink that, they're going to get drunk from it.
Right, so if somebody's lack of ability to walk a straight line or whatever they have you doing a sobriety test, we don't say, oh, well, they can't, you know, so we're not going to hold them responsible. No, they're going to take their license, they're going to pound their car, they're going to, you know, they might spend a night in jail. My point in giving that was that there are instances today of inability where there's still responsibility. Devin?
Mm-hmm. Ability, I don't know, you could kind of turn that into like evidence of like fruits or evidence of, I don't know where I was going with that, but that's all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is one example. I'm sure there's more. There actually is another better one that is floating in my gray matter somewhere, but I can't think of it right now. If you could think of one, let me know. Any, yeah, Matt?
Now, Arminianism and Pelagius and all, that's all heresies, right? That's been deemed as heresies, right? Like at the Council of Dort and all that.
Yeah, so Pelagianism was regarded as a heresy at the Council of Orange or Council of Ephesus. And the Arminianism was regarded as a heresy by the Dutch Reformed Church at the Synod of Dort in 1618. Well, it depends. Often those terms are used interchangeably. Often semi-Pelagian was not condemned at the Council of Orange. It was Pelagianism that was condemned. There is the difference, I mention it quickly, between semi-Pelagianism and Arminianism. Semi-Pelagianism teaches that man's remaining ability still remains in man's nature, that he's not totally corrupt. Whereas Arminianism says, well, yes, man is by nature totally corrupt, but he has the ability because God gives prevenient grace to all of humanity. It's a subtle distinction, but if you talk with a well-informed Arminian, he'll make sure you know the difference. There is a kind of evangelical Arminianism. If an Arminian still believes in imputed righteousness, justification by faith alone, I would say that it is a very serious error. I would be hesitant to call it heresy if we define heresy as outside the bounds of you know, gospel-believing Christianity. There is a kind of Arminianism that leads to other kinds of liberal theology that I would say, you know, is, you know, could probably be lumped in as heretical. But if it's a kind of evangelical Arminianism that still affirms justification by faith alone, imputed righteousness, then I would say it's still within the bounds, even though...
I know it's
Also, interesting, historically, Arminianism does not believe in the substitutionary atonement. If you look at the different systematic theologies with Arminianism, they believe in a governmental theory of atonement. So they don't believe that Christ actually paid for sins, and that's a very serious error. That's very serious. But it makes sense with the system because if there's an actual transaction taking place at the cross, then either he actually paid for all the sins of humanity, you know, or he paid for some of the sins of humanity. So it's in that sense, it is consistent with not believing in a definite atonement. Any other comments, questions? Kind of gone over time. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you that despite the darkness of all these passages, Lord, that you would show grace to us. You would show mercy, that you would send your Spirit to regenerate us so that we would lay hold of Christ by faith. Apart from you, we can do nothing. We thank you for not leaving us in our total corruption and inability, but giving us grace. In Jesus' name, amen.